This is an ABC podcast.
Right now, Europe's on the brink of the biggest invasion since World War II. Russia's ordered troops into eastern Ukraine. Leaders from around the world are desperately calling for calm. And Ukrainians are preparing for a full-blown invasion. Hey, it's Dave Marchese, and on Hack, we're telling you what's going on in Ukraine, and we'll ask an expert what this means for the world and Australia.
Hack.
He sounded like a Russian leader who is preparing his country for war.
On Triple J.
Russian tanks are reportedly rolling into parts of eastern Ukraine. This is what a lot of the world's been fearing for months, and the Russian President Vladimir Putin has declared that Ukraine has no history of being a true country. The United Nations has held an emergency meeting warning an invasion would lead to a humanitarian disaster. In a minute, we're going to get the lowdown from an expert. So if you've got a question about what's happening at the moment, please send it through 0439 757 555. But first, here's Ellie Grounds to bring you up to speed with what's going on in Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognise the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin delivered a speech broadcast to the nation on state TV. It went for nearly an hour and covered a whole bunch of things. But the takeaway that has gotten the world talking is this.
Back to the breaking news out of Russia at this hour, where the president there, Vladimir Putin, just signed a decree that recognizes two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine as independent states.
Those two regions are Donetsk and Luhansk. They're in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, close to the border with Russia. They're essentially already Russian-controlled. Russian-led separatists have been fighting with Ukrainian forces there since 2014. But now Putin has formally recognised their independence, and he's ordered troops there to do what he says are peacekeeping functions. But other countries aren't buying it.
Geopolitics 101. When one country sends soldiers and tanks uninvited into another country, that's called an invasion.
There's some suggestion that they're peacekeeping is nonsense. They have moved in on Ukrainian sovereign territory.
The United States is especially unhappy about the move. After Putin's announcement, US President Joe Biden signed an executive order imposing sanctions on Donetsk and Luhansk. That means no US investment or trade in that region. And the White House said in a statement it's ready and willing to go harder with more sanctions.
This executive order is distinct from the swift and severe economic measures we are prepared to issue with allies and partners in response to a further Russian invasion of Ukraine. We're continuing to closely consult with Ukraine and with allies and partners on next steps and urge Russia to immediately de-escalate.
So, is this the full-scale invasion of Ukraine that we've been talking about for weeks? Well, not yet, because it's territory that was occupied by Russian-backed forces anyway.
Doesn't mean it's the end of the invasion. I think it's tragically just the first couple of steps.
That's former US Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. He reckons there are around 190,000 Russian troops surrounding Ukraine right now, and sending troops to Donetsk and Luhansk is just the beginning.
It was a very, very angry speech. This is a man who feels aggrieved. He feels like he's justified, and it sounded to me like there's much more to come, but he sounded like a Russian leader who is preparing his country for war.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also addressed his country on TV, saying Ukraine won't concede any of its territory to Russia.
We are not afraid of anyone or anything. We don't owe anyone anything, and we won't give anything to anyone.
He's expecting Ukrainian allies, including the US, to take more steps. But Joe Biden has said the US isn't planning on sending its army to help.
What scenarios would you put American troops to rescue and get Americans out?
They're not. That's a world war. When Americans and Russians start shooting at one another, we're in a very different world than we've ever been in.
Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds reporting there, and your questions are coming through too. Jordana says, how would the possible invasion affect us in Australia? Well, someone who might know a bit more about this is Associate Professor Matthew Sussex from ANU. He's an expert in Russian foreign and security policy, and he joins us now. G'day, Matthew.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. I guess what everyone wants to know, are we about to see a massive war ignite in Europe?
Look, I don't think that we're going to get, you know, NATO and the US versus Russia. I think Washington's been pretty clear on that, that it's not prepared to send American forces to fight for Ukraine. Partly that's because Ukraine isn't a member of NATO, but also because, you know, a broad conflict like that would be absolutely horrendous, resulting in thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths. The question is, what, if you're not prepared to fight for Ukraine, is the United States and its allies prepared to do to try and dissuade Putin from going further?
Do you think it is too late to find a diplomatic solution to what's going on there?
Yeah, I do, actually. I thought this for a little while, but the nail in the coffin was basically Putin's pretty deranged speech that he gave to his Security Council today, where he basically tore up the Minsk II negotiation process, which had been, you know, something that all parties had thought, well, maybe we can revive that, by saying, no, we recognise Luhansk and Donetsk as independent countries, and more than that, we're going to send in Russian troops to, you know, safeguard their sovereignty. That basically says that diplomacy is finished now, and it's just the amount of punishment that can be brought to bear on him, I guess, that might sway him.
Well, speaking about that punishment, the US has already imposed some sanctions, but not the full-blown restrictions and sanctions they've warned of. Is there a risk that America might play their hand too early and actually make the situation worse if they respond with sanctions too early?
Look, there is a chance that that could happen, but then again, Putin will have factored this in. You don't create a massive invasion force, the biggest one that Europe's seen since World War II, and threaten to invade Ukraine without going through all the scenarios. So I think the probably calculation in the Kremlin is, let's see what we can get away with. Let's see what the Western response is. The gold standard Western response would be to cut Russia off from all money going into and out of Russia. But that's very, very unlikely to happen. What we might see instead is sanctions against oligarchs, those that are close to Putin, possibly even sanctions against Putin himself, as well as some targeted sanctions on Russia's ability to, you know, extract oil and gas, which is what its economy relies on.
Now, Ukraine has said that it's not afraid and it won't give up anything, any territory. Are they just strong words, or is Ukraine actually ready to fight Russia?
Oh, I think, you know, Ukraine probably will fight if it has to. If Putin decides to launch from the north, from Belarus, a big invasion driving at Kiev, they could potentially get there pretty quickly, and I think Ukraine will fight. I don't think they'll win, but nonetheless, they could certainly give the Russian military a bit of a bloody nose in the process. It's unlikely, I think, that Ukraine will capitulate at this stage, simply because the options open to them are all bad. If they went down the diplomatic route, they would have been forced to accept a deal where those breakaway Kremlin-backed separatists would have had a veto over their foreign policy and national direction anyway. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, I think, for Ukraine.
Matthew, we're getting a lot of questions asking us what this would mean for Australia. People saying, how could this affect us? We had the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, earlier today calling for Russia to step back and to stop threatening its neighbours. Does that carry a lot of weight from a country like Australia?
Well, Australia is a country that has prided itself very much on, you know, talking the talk about principles and values and standing up for democratic countries against bullies and standing up for the international order. And, you know, I think our words do carry some degree of weight internationally in that space. But if we are to make sure that we are a voice of significance, and I think we have to walk the walk as well, you know, have to do things like participate in sanctions regimes, have to look at things like, should companies like Russia Today be available, basically a propaganda arm of the Kremlin, should that be available on Foxtel? Those kinds of things that Australia can do to do more than just words and more than just strongly worded notes of protest.
The US says Vladimir Putin wants the world to travel back to a time when empires ruled the world. Do you think that is what the Russian president
is trying to do?
I don't think he's trying to recreate the USSR. He's said in the past that anyone who thinks that it could come back is an idiot. But there is a sense in which he has a kind of deep personal investment in the idea that Russia needs to be a great power, Russia needs to be treated seriously. And more than that, that some of the countries in the former USSR don't really deserve to exist as independent states. He wrote a very long, rambling, weird essay last year where he said the Ukrainians have never existed as a country. They don't have sovereignty. They don't have identity. They're all just Russians. He repeated that today in his address. And I think he does see that, you know, he's looking at his legacy. As a 70-year-old man, he'll be thinking about, well, what comes next and what mark do I leave on Russia? And he came to power with one simple promise, and that was, I will restore Russia to greatness. And it may be that this is the sort of end point of that design for him.
All right. Associate Professor Matthew Sussex from ANU, thank you very much for coming on Hack and for breaking all that down for us.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks.
Hack. Scott Morrison announcing a near $1 billion spending package to push back against Chinese and Russian aggression in Antarctica.
Triple J.
Well, speaking of territorial claims, who owns Antarctica? Because the Australian government's just promised $800 million to boost our claim to the territory. The money would be spent on surveillance drone fleets, temporary stations, and it comes as China and Russia ramp up their activity in Antarctica. It's also hoped the money will help to get us to parts of Antarctica that have never been explored. So why is there such a big priority for our government to do this? With me now is Professor Tim Stevens from Sydney University. G'day, Tim.
G'day, Dave. How are you?
Yeah, well, thank you. Australia claims more than 40% of Antarctica. Is that recognised around the world?
So it's neither recognised nor not recognised. So, Australia has the single largest claim, and we've maintained that for a very long period of time. And one of the genius features of the way that Antarctica is managed is that territorial claims have been put to one side by something called the Antarctic Treaty. So countries don't really have to claim or contest claims. They're all kind of put on ice, to use a perfectly appropriate cliche in these circumstances. And so the Antarctic Treaty says we're just going to not really talk about or discuss territorial claims. We're going to put them to one side. We're just going to get on with cooperating to manage Antarctica as a whole.
So who else has a claim or claims to own a bit of Antarctica?
Yeah, so there's seven claimants. So they include Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, France, Argentina, Chile. And then there's a couple of countries that have kind of reserved the right to make a claim. So the United States and Russia have both indicated that possibly they might make a claim. But again, coming back to the treaty kind of makes all those claims kind of irrelevant. And the treaty has this great provision saying nothing that happens during the life of the treaty can strengthen or weaken any of the claims. So they literally are just kind of frozen in time. Now, you know, that's what the law says. But of course, as your intro pointed out, there are countries that are doing lots of things in Antarctica. They are projecting power. And I think there is an anxiety that China in particular is kind of flexing its muscle and that there's a sense that we kind of have to use it or lose it, even though technically, legally, that's not a problem. It doesn't change anything. In kind of practicalities, there is a feeling that we need to be more prominent in, you know, using and researching and getting access to the very large slice of the kind of pizza that is Antarctica that falls in Australian hands.
So as you say, China's, you know, recently started boosting its presence in harder to reach parts of Antarctica. I think it's more of the central parts of Antarctica. Do we know what China's doing there?
Yeah, well, we do. We generally do because there are pretty strict reporting obligations under the Antarctic Treaty system. So China has to turn up to the meeting of Antarctic Treaty parties and tell other governments what it's up to. There's also an inspection system, so other governments can go and inspect Chinese stations. And actually, there's an opportunity there for a much more regular and rigorous inspections. Inspections, I think, need to happen much more frequently for governments to have confidence that that other parties to the Antarctic Treaty are doing the right thing in the Antarctic.
So the treaty that you are talking about, does that also talk about what can be done in Antarctica? Like, can countries use it for mining or military purposes or things like that?
So absolutely. So the Antarctic Treaty and a subsequent treaty called the Madrid Protocol or Environmental Protocol regulates Antarctica with a great level of kind of detail and attention. But these are the couple of key principles. First of all, Antarctica is reserved for peace and for science. So military activities are prohibited. You get into a bit of a grey area where military assets are used to undertake research, for instance, and questions arise as to, you know, whether or not there's kind of dual use going on, both military and civilian. And then when it comes to mining, mining is banned. So thanks to the Madrid Protocol back in 1991, mining is banned indefinitely in Antarctica. So yeah, it's reserved for peace and for science. And that really kind of underscores the Australian government's announcement of increased funding in Antarctica, because one of the features of Antarctic kind of governance and politics is that science does so much of the talking. It's often said that science is the currency of Antarctic politics. So if governments spend a lot of money on science and, you know, scientists with boots on the ground, they know more about what's happening in Antarctica. There's more profile in terms of what they're doing. And that through science, they can gain more kind of political influence. And so that's why there's such a science flavour to the government's announcement.
Very interesting. Well, another territory we'll all be keeping a close eye on. Professor Tim Stevens, thank you very much for your time.
An absolute pleasure, Dave.
And Ellen says on the text line, funny how ScoMo wants to claim and spend so much money on something that's diminishing with the prolonged use of coal.
Hack.
Our relationship in the beginning was fun, exciting. We would go on little adventures all the time.
Passionate, lots of heavy making out.
On Triple J.
Well, have you ever dated someone and they were really keen, messaging you nonstop, saying how much they're into you, sending you heaps of presents? I mean, of course, it can definitely be genuine, really romantic, but it could also be something a bit more toxic. It's called love bombing. So our friends over at The Hookup have been looking into it, and they've been hearing your stories about love bombing. And Dee Salmon has got a bit of an explanation, but a bit of a heads up. The story talks about emotional abuse and coercive control, so tap out if you need.
Are you wondering what the signs are for love bombing so you make sure it doesn't happen to you?
Love bombing is a one-way action.
You want to know what the biggest red flag in a relationship is that you're not going to want to believe?
So there's been a lot of chat lately about love bombing.
Hashtag West End Killed is literally...
Might have seen people talking about it on TikTok.
It's because this one man is love bombing every girl and then literally ghosting them.
Or maybe you watched the Tinder Swindler on Netflix.
He took me to a 5-star hotel.
He said we had a special connection.
It felt like stepping into...
People are even talking about Kanye West and saying that this is something that he did to actor Julia Fox as well.
Why do you not consider it love bombing?
Because he doesn't have like a shady ulterior motive.
If you don't know what love bombing is, it's basically when someone, I guess, bombs you with love. Like they're super keen on you really quickly. And don't get me wrong, that can be really romantic and genuine. I want to make that very clear. But it can also be something a little bit more toxic, where someone showers you in love and affection so they can get you hooked really quickly and then use it as a form of control. Well, that's what happened to Sam from Eora Nation Sydney. When we posted about it on our Instagram, she DM'd us about her experience.
So I met them via Tinder. I was 20 years old at the time. They were 27. I remember he opened with like, my God, you're gorgeous, or something like that. It didn't feel normal because it was like 0 to 100 in a very short amount of time. So even in like a week or two, it was like, I want to like lock this down. I want this to be official. It was probably like the third time we'd seen each other. And he just said to me, like really randomly off the cuff, like, I love you.
Because it was Sam's first proper relationship, at the time she said she didn't really know any better. She just thought, well, this is just dating, right?
Because I think it feeds into those sorts of romantic cliches of just like instant attraction, like just, you know, love at first sight.
But soon the love bombing stopped and the Tinder guy started being cold and he just kept pressuring Sam to have sex even when she didn't want to. Which, by the way, if it's not an enthusiastic yes, it's a no. Which I think we all know that by now.
You know, I express like, I'm not ready or something like that. He'd shame me for it. It was this whole thing of like, I'm obsessed with you, to like then resentment.
And then eventually the Tinder guy tried to ghost Sam.
So I essentially kind of called him out on it and basically just completely denied everything he said to me.
What Sam went through, I guess you could say, is a common love bombing experience in the dating world when someone comes on really strong and then ghosts you. But love bombing is also a common tactic of narcissists, and it's a way to keep someone in an abusive, controlling relationship.
So we met through a mutual friend, and he was a bit older. He was 28 years old.
Amy from NAR Melbourne met her ex, let's call him Jake, a few years ago. She wasn't really that attracted to him or keen, but no one had given her that much attention before.
He just kept pursuing, so he kept asking me out on dates, and I was quite excited, like I was thinking to myself, like, no one's really been this persistent with me before.
Just like Sam's experience, Jake told Amy that he loved her after the fifth date.
And then I received a 6-page letter from him. And it was pretty much just saying, like, how he'd met the one and I was the love of his life. And he wanted to marry me and have kids with me. And I was, like, so special and unique. And I made him feel so much better about himself.
After this, Amy started to fall for the guy, but then a shift happened and Jake had a bit of a pattern.
So pretty much our relationship was very up and down. He'd go from 0 to 100 and scream at me, and it would just be like out of control rage, and it would really scare me. And then the love bombing would start when it was bad. So when I would pull away, he would all of a sudden show up with like flowers and my favourite lollies and chocolate.
After a year together, Amy finally broke off the relationship, and it wasn't until she started talking about her experience online that she realised she was with a narcissist.
And that's when I was like going through these Facebook pages of listening to people's stories and just going, oh my God, I have gone through the exact same thing.
For both Sam and Amy, the impact of love bombing has been huge.
And I think it's going to take a couple of years to kind of go through it all and debrief and kind of understand that I'm not crazy and I'm not insane.
I mean, I still think I struggle with the fallout of it 6 years later, you know, and like it's also changed the way that I date, and I'm much more like suspicious of people.
Hack on Triple J.
Steve Salmon from The Hookup there. They've been investigating love bombing this week, and you can get right into this topic on their podcast. It'll be in your feeds tonight, so keep an eye out. Also, if this did bring up any feelings for you, Lifeline is always there, 13 11 14. And have you experienced love bombing? If you have, I want to know, 0439 757 555, or you can call in as well, 1300 055 36. Let us know your stories. Here to break this down a bit more is Dr. Zach Seidler. He's a clinical psychologist. Dr. Zach, g'day.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Yeah, well, thank you. We just heard some pretty full-on stories of love bombing there from listeners. How can you tell if someone is really into you or if it's something a bit more toxic than that?
Yeah, and I want to thank the women for coming forward with their stories. This is full-on information to share, and, you know, it's putting a vulnerability on the line. So I think that we need to start to break apart the fact that there's, you know, normal forms of romance that are really cute and lovely that you want to be a part of. And then there's this kind of pretty dangerous form of love bombing that is taking place in these stories, that we really need to start to understand that it's that exaggerated, consistent, you know, complimentary texting, planning for the future, expecting prompt replies, isolating you from your friends and family. It's when it's consistent behavior that happens really quickly, comes out of nowhere, and is kind of detaching you from your sense of reality. That's when you need to really pull back and go, well, what's going on here?
Yeah, we're getting a few stories in already. Maddie from Canberra says, I got love bombed by a guy for 3 years and it was always, I love you so much, and it turned into, you know, a really horrible situation. How can it be dangerous? What is coercive control?
So this is exactly, a form of coercive control, which is this push-pull of emotionality where the guy who is struggling with his own mental health, I would say in the vast majority of these cases, who is, you know, experiencing narcissism and various personality issues as well, he can't actually handle his own vulnerability. He can't handle some of his own self-esteem issues. And so what he does is he tries to exert control over something that he feels he has power over, being his partner in many instances. And as a result, what he does is he manipulates the situation so that he can control every and manipulate every moment of their interactions. And that gives him, that sense of self-esteem that fulfills those deep-seated insecurities that he's dealing with. So coercive control is that feeling that many people have when they're in pretty toxic relationships where they're not really sure where they stand with their partner. There's this up and down, constant rage and then extreme love, and they're pulled back in by these reinforcement cycles, which is what we call them, which is you can be punished endlessly, but you're just waiting for that moment for them to show you that love and warmth once again. And it's that, you know, constant what's on your mind, what is he going to do next? That's where the coercive control comes in. And it's a form of domestic abuse.
Yeah, well, somebody, Beck from Sydney, says it's not love bombing, it's just plain old abuse. Someone else says, literally just got out of a relationship with someone who love bombed me for a year and caused this toxic insecurity that I developed. Is there a particular kind of person, Zach, that usually does this? Is it narcissists or a certain type of character?
So sadly, what we've seen and what we've seen in Tinder Swindler as well is that the vast majority of these people are males. And that comes down to all of this power and privilege dynamic that happens. You can also go back and blame Disney if you want, just looking at the way that romance was sold to young girls back in the day. You can see how this image of being pulled into something where they're going to hold you and offer you all of this security and protection and, you know, be the breadwinner, all of this narrative is really, really dangerous. And then underlying that for these guys is often this narcissism, this lack of self-worth. And it's really weird because when you talk about narcissists, you expect them to always, think that they're on top of the world. But actually what's underneath a narcissist is always this idea of fragility. And we can look at Donald Trump, for instance, to see this idea of fragile narcissism where it looks like he's projecting everything to the world, but underneath is this shallowness in a way. And so in an attempt to try to deal with that feeling of not being good enough, they push further and further. They try to be, you know, everything to everyone. And that's just an inability to face up to, you know, what are real vulnerabilities in their life. And so they put on a mask. They often gaslight and put on an act which keeps them at an arm's distance and shields them from ever being abandoned or broken up with, which is really their greatest fear. It's just a massive power play in the end.
Hack on Triple J.
Dr. Zach Seidler there, and that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.